Howard Lindzen is the founder and general partner at Social Leverage. All opinions expressed by Howard and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Social Leverage or StockTwits. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for decisions. Guests may maintain positions and securities discussed in this podcast.
Welcome to Panic with Friends, and please greet your host, Howard Lindzen.
Any applause?
No applause today. Sorry.
What's up?
Not much. How you doing?
Good. It's winter. We have winter week.
We had snow in Phoenix yesterday.
I was driving my car and it was a fucking snowstorm. There were people just firing off shotguns in the snow while they were driving. There was an unknown Arizona rule that when it snows and you're in your car, you can just fire weapons.
I didn't know about that rule.
Yeah, but well, this is why we live in Arizona, for these rare occasions where you can shoot from your minivan. I don't even know where I made up that from. But I was driving yesterday, driving for lunch, and it's a fucking storm hit. Rain was coming sideways, and then ice.
Yeah.
And then I think I saw like a monster, but it was just some person covered in snow. And there was still snow at the end of the day.
And you were driving on four-wheel drive and all-season tires.
Yeah, I got out and put chains on. Because, you know, I'm Canadian. We have chains everywhere.
Right.
So I left a little bit of a trail on Camelback Road. From my chain car on the road. But hey, I'm a taxpayer and they can fix that for us.
Of course.
So I have a great guest, prolific investor.
Wonderful.
He's in Florida, I believe. He's a New Yorker, an incredible entrepreneur. Started Inbyte Media, which was acquired by Google, with his partner, Nat Turner. Then they started Flatiron Health, which was acquired by Roche Pharmaceuticals. He's only 34 years old. They've already had
a couple
of huge exits, including a multi-billion-dollar exit to Roche. And it's a cancer research company that him and Nat put together. So I want to do a little bit of backstory, but more talk about the future.
Okay.
This is not about the past. There is so much going on in front of us. And Zach and his partner, Nat, are like prolific check writers into entrepreneurs. So I want to see how they're thinking about the future. And of course, maybe we'll talk about panic because COVID, you know. And I want to catch up a little bit about cancer research, et cetera, because it's part of the hot biotech sector. And, you know, is that okay with you, Canoe?
I'm perfectly okay
with
that.
All right, so let's get Zach on the phone.
We will.
Zach!
How you doing?
Great! Welcome to Panic with Friends. Was there a moment of panic at any time in your startup? You're only 34. I think you started Inbyte Media when you were 11.
Yeah, I was my bar mitzvah money, actually.
You parlayed your bar mitzvah money into Inbyte Media. How old were you at Inbyte? 18?
We started, I was turning 20.
And you went to school with Nat, or?
Yeah, we met freshman year at Penn. We were Wharton undergrads in 2004. And we started it between our junior and senior year of college.
What was the, because you're 20, and so you're passing the bong around, or whatever you two guys do. With Nat, it was probably just carbs. And
just pizza.
I know he won't listen, so let's just make fun of his body weight. He's a hockey player body. So you're sitting with Zach, you're eating pizza, and you're 20. And because you're at a good school, you have business ideas. So was it the first idea you two had?
You know, it was one of these, I guess, luck merged with a little bit of good timing. We had gotten to know Josh Koppelman, the First Round Capital founder,
yep,
and also a working guy. And I think that was the connection. He got us an internship the previous summer at one of his early portfolio companies in San Francisco, a company called VideoAgg at the time.
It's now
Say Media. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is back in the day.
Yeah.
And, from that internship, we just had some early exposure to online advertising from kind of like the inside out, you know, like how the technology worked before we understood how advertising worked. Mm-hmm. The idea came from there. It came from that internship over the summer. So, you know, not pontificating in a room, but out in the field, if you will, working at a small company. And that was the genesis.
So you take this company, you're young guys, you get an exit to Google. So now you got Google on your resume. Was Google fun? Was Google interesting? What was the biggest surprise?
You know, I've said this to Nat a few times. I don't think Flatiron is the success that it was without Google. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, we were good at technology back when we were starting this, but the first company, but we didn't really know like what it meant to run an actual business operationally. Had no idea because we'd never had a real job before. And when we got to Google, we had sold the company. We were maybe 52 people, 55 people. And I remember getting into Google and like by the third day turning to Nat and going, oh yeah, we have no idea what we're doing. Like this company actually understands how to run a business. And so the 2 years we spent there learning was really about like, how do you build a company and how do you build a culture that builds the company? And that was the best exposure to company building that I mean, we needed it. And we used a lot of those learnings from Google when we started Flatiron 2 years later. So it was great. It was great. I mean, obviously I don't agree with every single thing they do, but it's an amazing company.
Here's my take on Google from knowing you about an inch deep, because I don't get the chance to spend time with you, and you thankfully are an LP in our funds and we're doing well and you're prolific yourself. But it's so funny because everybody's an expert on Twitter, and obviously I love following you on Twitter because you don't lack for opinions. And I remember in March, you know, because I talk about stocks a lot, and I remember in March, I didn't want to hear the noise because I started this podcast called Panic with Friends in March, and I'm like, fuck, it's too late to panic. And everybody was panicked. And then I remember buying a lot of Google because I don't like to listen to people when they're talking about big companies. I just know what I want to know, and I have my positions and I have my price levels. And I remember buying Google at around 1,000, and it was just like, what? Like the markets were coming unglued, and I understood a lot of why the markets were coming unglued. And then I just randomly saw a tweet from you, and literally at the same moment in time, you were buying Google at around 1,000. And I was like, huh, he sold his company to Google. And you either hate him, even if he hates him, he's buying the stock. And from someone, you know, it's just made so much sense not to panic. And why was Google on your list? And what made you think March was a buying opportunity?
Yeah, I mean, it was a good decision. So
yes,
I'm glad we both.
900 points since then. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a nice call. You know, look, my impression from working at Google and even just now observing as an outsider, as the internet grows, Google grows. And they're just so like intricately linked in their ultimate outcomes. If you look at it in a 10, even 20 year horizon, that, you know, if you're going to bet on the rise of the internet for more and more commerce and just broadly speaking, the overall economy, Google is a simple bet on that kind of topic. So when I saw the world collapsing, my first instinct was, okay, well, I guess everybody's just going to be on their computer all day. And that was it. I was like, if that's what's going to happen, Google's going to go up because that's how it works. And, you know, there'll be a little bit of a pullback in SMB spending, and that's what happened. But overall, it'll come out stronger and healthier. And actually, I ended up buying Google, Snapchat, and Shopify all on the same day.
Snap was the big winner for me, too, percentage-wise of all the things that I bought that I've actually continued to hold today, because it's up like 400-500%.
Well, what are college-age kids and, you know, people in their 20s going to do all day when they can't socialize? They're going to do it on their phone. So there goes Snap. But Google to me just felt and continues to feel, frankly, I mean, I'd still buy it today. Yep. You get to buy the internet essentially with Google. So you have all of growth of online advertising with them. You get YouTube, which seems to me like as a standalone business could itself be $100 billion, you know, market cap company. And then you kind of get like a free option on GCP, even though it's in third place.
What's GCP? Oh, cloud, private cloud.
The cloud. Yeah. The Google Cloud Platform. Uh-huh. And then you get this fun little option on Waymo, which, you know, I think is a really material lead. So it just felt like a nice, safe, close your eyes, hold it for 5 years kind of bet. And I've held every single share I bought. So we're long-term holders. I don't think I'll touch it for years.
And do you love investing?
You know, it's funny. I prefer the startup stuff. I really enjoy the seed and early stage investing because I feel like I can contribute in a way that other people can't, just having been through the tactical day-to-day work. On the public side, you know, I have most of my friends are in finance and many are in hedge funds, you'd know. And anytime I talk to them, I'm always reminded how much more they know than me about pretty much everything. And so I always felt like in the public markets, I'm coming at this from a pretty severe disadvantage. These people are very, very sharp. And so, you know, I buy the names I know and have some very basic positions, but I much prefer the startup work.
So you're at Google, and we'll come back to end around investing. So now I just want to go back. You're at Google, you and Nat. Whose idea was it around Flatiron Health? How did that come about, and how did you pull yourself out of Google?
I mean, I think most startup ideas are an evolution. You know, they start as one thing and they start as a conversation, and you kind of keep doing research and the idea gets better and better. And that's what happened with Flatiron. I think we just got a little disillusioned in doing online advertising and wasn't what I wanted to spend my time thinking about. And remember, this is 2011. So this is the Affordable Care Act and some of these early news on some of these new oncology therapies. It was just interesting. Nothing more than that. We just thought it was an interesting space and something we would like to spend our time on. And over the course of about 18 to 24 months, we did what I would describe as like primary market research, talking to experts in the area from all different walks of life, just understanding the mechanics of how this world worked, not just, you know, the terms, but how the money flowed, what the problems were, who the players were. And Flatiron as an idea evolved from 250 plus conversations over the course of 2 years. And what one of the best things we had, frankly, was Google Ventures made a whole bunch of introductions for us to industry people. So we shortcut, you know, 6 months of hounding people over email, because when GV makes an intro, people take the intro. So we got to do years of market research in a much more condensed time period because of the credibility they brought. And then we could also talk about, you know, having sold our last business. So I felt like it was a place we could use our experience to our advantage. And we just got sucked into it. And now, I mean, I guess I'm a healthcare person at this point. I always considered myself more of a tech person broadly, but now I do spend quite a bit of time just on healthcare and healthcare specific companies.
And so you start that. Who did you go to for the first check?
To Google. We went back to Google.
And was it a yes right away?
Yeah. I mean, Nan and I funded the kind of pre-seed, if you will, ourselves. So, you know, we each put in a little bit of our own money to get off the ground. And that was one of the advantages we had. And then as we picked up our first set of clients and we kind of proved that, all right, access to this underlying data we thought was interesting was doable. We pitched it to Google and they said yes in the meeting. So Krishna, the GV partner who invested, always used to tell me, you know, every time he introduces people to healthcare, they spend 3 months, they come back and say, you know what, I think I'm going to stick to tech.
Yeah.
And I understand why.
Yeah.
And we were the opposite. We kind of got sucked into these complex multi-stakeholder problems, probably because Nat and I are good, not great at software. Like, I think we are good software developers and good product people, but we're not great. And putting that skill set in an industry where software was one piece of the puzzle, but you had to do business development, you had to learn how to do sales, partner, you know, the whole gamut. We felt we had a little bit of an advantage in a more complex area. Starting something like a Slack or a Figma or Envision, you know, any of these like real true software companies, I think we would have gotten beat up by competition.
Yeah, it's a great point. So did you take first funding in 2013? Is that when you stepped out of Google?
We left Google summer of 2012. So we had right on the, basically on the 2 year mark, and we raised from GV kind of the end of 2012, somewhere around then, November, December or so.
And when did Roche come in, 2017 or 18?
They invested in our Series C. They led our Series C as a strategic investor and took a board seat in 2017-ish. Mm-hmm. I don't remember the date, probably January. And then they bought the company April of 2018.
And it was near 2 billion?
Yeah, right around there.
And what does that feel like? Because, you know, I'm a thousandaire. What does that feel like? Is there like it's such an incredible accomplishment, and I have a lot of, you know, I've had some billionaires on the show. Maybe you're not a bill, but you know what I mean. People who have $1 billion outcomes. And did it feel any different than the invite media? Because that was also a great exit to Google. Did it feel different?
You know, it's funny. I think I was more excited about the invite media exit than mm-hmm. the Roche one, even though the scale was quite different. Mm-hmm. Maybe because, you know, with invite, everything was on the line. I mean, I dropped out of school. We didn't have a track record of anything. You know, we kind of started this with nothing underneath. And this is 2007, right? So this is before dropping out of college was like a cool thing to do. YC wasn't like a real opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Now, obviously, things have changed. And I think that acquisition was really, it changed my mentality of like, okay, I think I can actually do this as a career.
Correct.
With this one, look, you know, obviously it's a lot of money and that's great. I think the thing we were most excited about with the Roche acquisition from like a long-term standpoint is we could now pick what we wanted to do for the rest of our life. And that's been the most intriguing is just, you kind of have unlimited flexibility to spend time as you want to. And I think that's what I was most excited about is like the time freedom. And, so yeah, it's been good. I mean, I have no complaints.
And what is the thing that gets you fired up? Obviously, a founder walks in with something, but what, there's got to be a sector or it's not just the next app. Or what is it? Because you write a lot of checks, as you should, as I would do, because it's fulfilling. And fulfillment is the name of the game. But there's a different scales of fulfillment. You know, you got your friends calling you for deals. Like it's, you know, I'm part of this social leverage or this scale that we all have. And this accessibility, like me bugging you to come on this podcast, like we can all peck away at each other, but what is the motive? Like, how do you get motivated? Maybe it's you're just young and you're motivated, but like, what is it that fires you up?
You know, I've asked myself the same question, right? Like, why am I excited in the morning? I'll give you kind of two or three answers because I think it's not one individual thing. I think there's a combination of events. The first thing that always stands out to me is when we meet technical founders, so people who have an engineering background or some sort of technical background, and they're applying that technical background in a way that's very, very clever from like a business model standpoint. And this we see just a lot in healthcare because healthcare business models are a little atypical, they're not obvious. And I can see how much of an impact that has because you get clever engineering focused founders in markets where that just has never existed before. Mm-hmm. And those kind of outcomes maybe aren't always the biggest financially per se, although they do tend to be relatively big, but the impact they can have because you've got a different type of brain thinking about this problem. And I love that. I mean, you know, two, three people, one or two have an engineering background and they've just nailed like, here's how we're actually going to take this to market, not just the tech. So it's a little bit of a weird answer, but I've always loved that. And then now that we've been doing this for, you know, a decade, we started angel investing back in 2011. I get to watch every day at this point, it's crazy. Some of these founders who, you know, they were two people when we backed them or three people when we backed them. And now they're running $100 million, a few $100 million, and in some cases, multi-billion-dollar businesses. And just kind of watching them grow into that type of founder, having known them when, you know, they were worried and all the risk was on the table, and having that kind of relationship where I can still make fun of them to their face, even though now they're like all powerful and no one else will do it. So I just, it's really great to have that relationship and to be a sounding board for people who I think, you know, when you hit a certain level of success, it's hard to find other people to confide in. It's hard, you know, everyone wants something from you. And, I think having a relationship with these founders, we don't really want anything from them. We're just here to support them has been really fun. So I've got a handful of those relationships now. And, you know, I'll probably, as I get off this podcast, I'm sure I'll have a few text messages from folks asking questions and advice, things like that. So I do really enjoy it.
Well, we're going to change your name to protect you. So it'll be Zip Weinstein that people hear every yeah. time we say your name. So Zip That's Weinstein, it. We apologize for the inbound. So how old are your kids?
We have two boys, a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old. So it's a little bit of chaos.
What do you see is out there? What are they using that blows your mind? What's the 3-year-old doing that gets you mad and happy?
You know, at three, I mean, we try our best to limit like the tech per se, but I will say the availability of like alternative learning has just been really surprising to me. And I've never really thought, I went to public school. I went to the same school from when I was 4 until college. So never had to like think about school choice and options. I went to a very, very good school in New York, and it was just never, I never considered that there were problems in other areas until I got older. And I think with him, you know, my wife and I, the older boy, at least now that he's starting, have started to talk about, all right, well, what else should we be looking at? I mean, school is one vector, if you will, and that'll be fine. But there's all these alternative education platforms out there. Should we be pursuing those? Is it complementary? Does it eventually replace school? There's just so much going on in education that I'm still learning about. So I think that's been surprising to me.
And so in 15 years, when your kid's first one's ready for college, does it exist? Do you think it would be acceptable for kids not to go to college? What's your gut?
I think you see real, like the top tier schools will thrive for another 100 years. There's just signaling value and the social experience and kind of the network value. I think that will maintain. So that will be there. I do think you're going to see more and more people take a different approach to college. Maybe they do just the engineering program. They drop the liberal arts piece and maybe they don't graduate, but they get the education on their resume. It's going to flatten out is my guess. You have multiple paths, and having not gone to college or having not gone to Penn as an example, I don't think is going to be a big issue going forward. So nothing too crazy, right? It's not like a binary switch. No one goes to college anymore, but alternative tracks, I think, are going to be completely reasonable. And in some cases, especially in engineering areas, I think potentially encouraged. So the only thing I will say that I think will be true in 16 years is I don't think my kid is ever going to drive a car. I doubt it. Doesn't make sense to me.
Front seat or back seat? What do you think they'll be?
I think you just, the alternative of self-driving for the areas where it can work, plus, you know, the Uber Lyfts of the world for everything else. And, you know, what is a cell phone going to look like in 16 years? There's no way they want to drive a car. They're going to want to play on their phone or whatever future iteration of the phone there is.
Do you own Uber or Lyft? Because you own a lot of stuff. So I imagine, are those two companies around in 15 years?
I don't own them, mostly just on valuation. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a little bit concerned about, can they actually make money? Mm-hmm. But if you looked at my credit card bill back before the pandemic, you know, it would look like I was a giant fan. So massive fans of the product. Stock-wise, you know, not my area of expertise. But yeah, I think they exist, and we'll see like what iteration of Uber it looks like. And I think Waymo is going to be a really serious potential player in this area. It's just going to take longer than people think. It's not in the next 5 years.
And Waymo, meaning the operating system, the OS?
Yeah, I think Waymo as an entity, meaning, you know, either running their own taxi service themselves in partnership with a manufacturer, mm-hmm. to selling the OS to an Uber or a Lyft. I mean, Google's MO as a company, right, is to try and be the platform, not always the end consumer. They're not always great at that. So we'll see. But from a technical perspective, I think they have such a lead over everybody else that I expect they'll be out in front.
Okay, that's cool. I learned something new because Waymo wasn't even in my Google 20-year. When I explained Google, you explained it for me well. I would have added Google as great hedge fund. Google as investor, you're getting that option out, using their data to make good bets, better bets than the average tech investor could do. Does that count anything to you?
I don't know if it's material for the market cap. I mean, they're a $1 trillion plus market cap. And while I think the world of Google Ventures and their investing, I don't think you can underwrite an investment in Google itself and Alphabet based on that.
Okay. That's good to know. And is there another company that, like, when it drops 30%, you've got an alert and you go, that I'm buying the dips. Is there any other company that stands out to you, like number one, that you're like, oh, you know, blindly you see it down 25-30%. It's like, I'm on it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's kind of trite to say it these days, but every time Shopify dips, I buy it. And it is the e-commerce bet that you want to make if you believe most of shopping is moving online. You own Shopify, and then you have to own Amazon. And if you own an index fund, you own a lot of Amazon anyway. So I love betting on long-term secular trends and betting on the clear winner. I mean, this isn't rocket science, right?
No, I mean, it's top five for me, Shopify, and I've owned it since in the 50s or under 100. So, but the venture capitalists were happy to sell it as it went public. So there's so many lessons in this. What was it when it triggered to you? When did it become a core idea to you?
the minute I bought something via Instagram, because I guess everybody falls into that trap these days, and I used Shop Pay to check out, and I think it took me 14 seconds to go from Instagram to fully checked out, knowing that this package was going to arrive relatively quickly and I had tracking on it. I mean, there's that experience was like, okay, got it. This is what shopping looks like going forward. And Shopify can bring this to the non-Amazons of the world. And that was it. I think
because they power the stores.
They power the stores, they power the payment, and then soon enough they'll power much or all of the logistics over the next decade. So it's just a monster. And again, you know, going back to that same thesis of as the internet grows, Google grows, I think we will slowly start to see the same argument made about Shopify, right? If I mean, people make this already today. As e-commerce grows, Shopify grows. And when you're the default platform, I mean, even just like the financial services options they can offer their customers, from receivables financing to the you know, the actual payment flow.
Also the store, they're just their ecosystem.
Totally.
So does that mean you will pass on DTC type investments? Because I love it. You know, the only thing that gets me out of bed is like discovering the next Lulu or being part of the next Peloton brands. Meaning it's not really, I don't think people should do this other than in the public markets. You know, I do it with Nike and Lulu and Peloton, but I call it fashology. Does that interest you at all, knowing that you know Shopify and e-commerce or that, or do you avoid that?
I feel like I don't understand it. And so we don't invest directly in kind of direct to consumer stuff unless there's a technical advantage. So, you know, if there's something in the way the product is manufactured or distributed or discovered, you know, we'll do it. But generally speaking, I don't touch like direct to consumer stuff. But I just don't think I get it better than anyone else. So I might as well stay away.
And have you met Toby or any or Harley at the team?
Ah, oh, my Toby story. God, and there's no way he remembers this either. Back in like 2009 or 10, maybe, can't remember the year. I was at a dinner in New York, First Mark, which was one of their early investors.
Yeah, great investors.
Used to do these amazing guys. And we were at a dinner, you know, just like a bunch of founders in New York. And I guess Toby was in town. And I sat down at the dinner next to him. I turned over, said, hey, you know, introduced myself. What do you do? And he said, oh, you know, Shopify. And I said, cool. Sounds like an interesting business. And then just like went about my day. And this is probably at their Series A, you know, and I was investing at the time. So I'm like sitting next to the single best investment I could ever made and just like ignored it.
I've heard him speak. I mean, I really am having Harley on my pod. I'm excited to talk to Harley. He's Hamish a guy, but I just wouldn't have caught it. So it just didn't dawn on you?
Oh, 100%. I mean, he's that's his personality. And I think that's probably why they're long-term successful. But yeah, I had no idea. I sat right next to him probably for 90 minutes at a dinner. And shame on me.
And what's the biggest pass you've made? We've all, like, I think it's helpful because obviously you're super successful and it's fun to talk about wins. What's one that you walked in and you're like, because you're moody. I see you. And
that's the inner Jew, you know, it comes out of us at all times.
Yeah, that's why people say Jewy, because it's a moody Jewish guy. I think it's lovable, unlike some other people on Twitter, because I totally get you, even though I don't know you that well. Because you don't want to be a prick, but some people just demand prickdom. So I appreciate that in seeing that. My superpower is being able to maneuver amongst the moody people. So the moody person they are, who came in and just got completely wrong other than shot, like as a seed, you came in and you're like, leave me alone.
There's probably 20 of these, you know.
No, that's a good answer. There is, but it's one that just like, Jesus Christ, I'm such an idiot.
I'll give you like a kind of an esoteric answer. There's a company, it's a private business, but there's a company called Carbon Health. I don't know if you're familiar.
I think I am. I think Jeff Richards, maybe GGV did it.
So think
Is it the
software.
Tesla guys? Is it the Tesla guys? Someone from Tesla that started it?
No, this is in healthcare. This is a think software-enabled primary care.
Okay.
And back in 2016, 17 or so, when I was still, you know, day to day overwhelmed with Flatiron, I get an email trying to introduce me to Aaron, the founder. And Aaron's got this amazing background, right? He was also the founder of Udemy, So second time founder.
You know what? Russ Fraden knows all these guys. Do you know Russ Fraden? Yeah, he's amazing. He's an LP as well. Yeah. So yeah, of our fund. So Russ is amazing. That's where I've heard it. Okay. So Russ was, yep. Got it. Keep going.
And, you know, I did the like classic jaded healthcare thing, which was amazing because I'd only been doing healthcare 4 years. I was already jaded. Yeah. Like an idiot. Uh-huh. And I was like, I don't know, like another one of these tech guys trying to do healthcare. Like, I can't do this meeting. Uh-huh. And 2 years later, I get the exact same email at a much higher price saying, hey, do you want to meet Aaron? And I'm like, why is this name so familiar? Like, because now at this point, I know the company, right? It's super successful. It's got some, he really executed amazingly. And I go back in my emails and I look at it, I'm like, oh, I'm an idiot. I didn't even take the meeting. Yeah. I just on the pitch, I said no. So, yeah. You know. It happens.
It happens. One of the joys of this business is the endless opportunities. You can't focus. Of course, I've made you dig up that story so that you'll be annoyed with me the next time I call you, because that's a gift that I have. But I think it's important for people to know that we fuck up, right? Like, we're busy. We have great networks and stuff slips through the cracks. Is there a deal? Is there an idea? Is there a team? Is there a company? Is there something you would drop everything and go back to operator mode?
There's a few healthcare companies that I would consider it, just like the potential impact that they have. Funny enough, actually, I actually think Carbon with Aaron would be one of them.
Wow.
Maybe I'll ask him for the equivalent number of shares I would have.
What had. I would do is just send him an email tomorrow and say, listen, did you ever get my wire? Sometimes it works.
Yeah, I've tried. He's surprisingly wily. Effective at Gmail search for my past.
I'm not. That's worked on me. Okay. So you, Carbon Health, is there something else out there?
Yeah, there's another company, and I think you'll start to hear more and more about them over the next few years, based in New York, called Imogen. Hmm. And the way I describe Imogen, and you know, there's lots of details here to go into, but AI for radiology that actually works.
AI for radiology that works. Meaning, I go in, they do the X-ray, and I know right away?
Right away, with accuracy that's materially better than the human. And, you know, this has been the promise of AI, really more machine learning very specifically in healthcare for some time, right? That it would eventually get better than the doc. And it's been a lot of hype and a lot of failures and some big profile failures, or companies where, you know, they talked a big game, but when you dug underneath the hood, there was nothing really there. A lot of papers published, but really small sample sizes. And Imogen is just doing it right. And you'll start to see some of the data as their FDA clearances come out over the next 12 to 24 months. Mm-hmm. And I've seen the internal clinical trial data that they have. It's so good that the idea that a human being is going to read an X-ray, as an example, in 5 years, to me is crazy. There's no way. I mean, there'll be edge cases, stuff that, you know, the computer's never seen before, but 95% of the volume, I think we're going to go from, hey, the computer's really good at having it quickly, and yes, that's a value, right? Rapid turnaround time, mm-hmm. to a world where people are asking, hey, did the computer read this? Because I want to make sure the human didn't miss something.
Correct.
That's the quality of the underlying tech of this company. And I've seen not just the ML team that's doing this, but the actual clinical results, like the patient results. And they're catching stuff. They're catching lots of things that humans miss because, look, humans get tired.
Humans are lazy.
They get annoyed.
Let me just tell you a story, Zaki. Lean back. I was with my partner, Tom, and I had, of course, I didn't know what it was. I was doubled over. I thought I had food poisoning a year and a half ago. And I said, I can beat this. And I go to the hockey game with Tom in Phoenix. I'm in the middle of fucking nowhere. Sidebar, Coyotes, stadium's in the middle of nowhere. And I get to the game and I'm like, this isn't working. And I get in an Uber and I just say, take me to the closest hospital. And it's in bumfuck Phoenix. And, you know, flash forward 2 weeks to a bowel obstruction to almost dying from a staph infection, where I was just kind of at the whim. You know, like, you're in that mood and you're like, it's a hospital. I'll go with the flow. But it was such a roller coaster of shit. Not having that power or any semblance of what the fuck was going on. If my wife wasn't there as my advocate, I'm a goner.
Yep.
That was scary. And I know that happens to so many millions of people that go into the system that don't have advocates. So we need this technology to work. And those are like the edge cases that we haven't put enough time and money and energy at. And so do you have to get political to do this at some point? So does Imagine have to get political to push? You need the capital and the energy and the time to not just do the technology. You got to go fight the system.
I mean, I think there's always things from like a legislative, political standpoint that would help. Healthcare is so big that there are enough markets inside the healthcare system that, you know, you don't need politics to make a really big impact. Now, don't get me wrong, there are things that I would push to change, but it doesn't present like an obstacle just yet at this point. It's interesting because you mentioned the word advocate, and it's something I tell almost anybody I know that has like a medical issue or a health issue, which is if you don't have somebody advocating for you or you're not doing it yourself,
say goodbye.
Yeah, you'll get lost. And there's a really simple, I think there's a really simple reason for this, which is at the end of the day, nobody's on the hook for you. Mm-hmm. Now this changes when you turn 65. Right? This changes when you shift onto Medicare. And now there are these, you know, kind of massive public companies that are focused on Medicare Advantage, like Clover Health, which is...
Sure. SPAC was first.
Yeah.
Round.
Through Chamath. Yeah. And...
Congrats. It's rather boring saying congrats to you, by the way, but that was good. Well played.
Appreciate it. So one of the beautiful things about Medicare Advantage is the insurance company at the end of the day is responsible for your total cost of care, meaning... The government gives them a fixed amount of money, and then they have to go make sure that you're healthy and that you don't blow through that number on a population basis. And so they have to care because the incentives are right. And so you see Medicare Advantage plans and companies like Clover actually investing in technology and services to manage people's care because sick people are expensive people. And I think that's one of the interesting things that happens, right? If you show up with a bowel obstruction or the staph infection or any of the other issues, you're really, really expensive.
Whew.
And so if you get somebody who cares, they will manage you. The problem is people mostly under 65 get their insurance from their employer. And the challenge with an employer-driven insurance model is your insurance company changes so frequently, either because you change your job or because your employer changes the insurance provider. And in many cases, by the way, the actual person on the hook for your total care is your employer. So there's so much churn going through the system that they just can't cost effectively invest in long-term health because by the time they reap the benefits, you're probably at a different job. And so they don't reap the benefits. And that's the problem with employer-driven insurance is It's short-term oriented thinking. And a best example I can give you, really simple things, but getting you to quit smoking probably doesn't save the insurance company any money if it's employer driven, because the smoking cost is going to come back to bite you in the ass when you're older. You know, so if they were responsible,
you'll have already been off and on and switched and.
Yeah. You're like nine jobs later, you know? And so they don't invest in long-term health.
So
and really, you know, health insurance is, it's not one market. We have lots of weird markets and, you know, Medicare, because of the long-term nature, you're on their rolls until you die. Mm. So there is that incentive. But in the employer world, which is, you know, again, people under 65,
this is
mostly
solvable the way you're describing it to me. This is American solvable.
Yeah. I mean, very simply, we should not be getting our health insurance from our job.
Oh, God. That's you just explained step one. To me. That's literally it.
Yeah. That's a driver of, you know, not all. There's other issues, but that is a material
driver. That would be material. The government should be able to figure that one out. Interesting.
Yeah. And there's stuff coming. I mean, we'll see what the Democrats do. You know, is there a public option? So the idea behind that, I mean, it means a lot of things to a lot of people, but there's a general idea saying, hey, instead of actually getting insurance from your job, you get a check from your job and you can use that check to buy into Medicare. That would be the idea.
Yeah. And in a world of Venmo and Square, come on, people. Okay. I'm really excited. So to recap, Google, Shopify, yep. Education in a way that you're saying, because you have two young kids, my takeaway from your thoughts on education that stands up from this conversation is signaling matters. So, but that just means the gap gets wide. And so there's huge opportunities in startups for education over the next 15 years. And then fourth, healthcare. I mean, fish where the fish are. Oh, and Amazon. So e-commerce, Shopify, Google, healthcare, and obviously Waymo. Great discussion. If you were, I mean, you're only 34, so I'm a little bit pissed at this point, and I don't know if I can continue. I mean, this is not fair. I mean, I'm 55. I have to manscape. Like, I had to manscape before this interview, and 40 minutes later, I have to manscape again. You don't even have to think about that stuff yet. Could you grow a beard, Zach?
I've been trying for the last 2 years. It's just coming in.
Well, see, you can't have everything. So if you could solve one problem in the States, you think, like, you're Biden, you can wave one magic wand that would help the most people, what would it be?
Well, I'll give you two things. Sure. But I think, you know, I'll focus on healthcare specifically, just because maybe that's the most interesting. Mm-hmm. So healthcare and biotech to me are two very distinct markets. And, you know, you asked about what am I excited about? I mean, we are on the cusp of a biotech revolution. We're already really there.
Yeah, you see it in the indexes, right? I'm long and I don't understand it, but I'm just long.
Yeah, I mean, and you can see it in the COVID vaccines, mm-hmm. right? The
fucking Moderna is insane.
And it's not just Moderna, it's the sure. Pfizer.
J&J, one shot.
Well, so what's interesting is the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines are using this mRNA technology that is brand new, hasn't been here for a while, whereas the J&J vaccine vector is kind of a more classic technology. And so imagine for a second, you know, this pandemic happens like 5 years ago or 10 years ago. We're still waiting for the first vaccine, if that's the case.
Got it.
So I think what we are on the cusp of in biotech, and again, you're seeing it in the beginning now, is the tools have gotten so much better that the amount of kind of progress you can make in a very small team reminds me of what happened to computing, you know, back in the 2000s, if you will, where, mm-hmm. and even before that, you know, you had to get your own data center and you had to run your own machines and you had to figure out how to do all of the actual scaling infrastructure and just like friction points that had absolutely nothing to do with the product. And then those slowly got, you know, whittled away and you're like four SaaS contracts from I could launch an app without ever, you know, touching a back end.
Correct.
Which is amazing, right? Like, I, you know, myself and a designer could get something out the door tomorrow. And that's what's happening in tech.
Like no code is like fucking phenomenal.
No code, low code. Just there's so many options to get something out the door.
Yeah.
And in biotech, that's never been the case. And it's beginning to change. You're starting to see the tools available to scientists and to drug developers are materially better and cheaper. So we have a long biotech 20-year thesis. We just don't know how to pick the names because I don't have a PhD.
Correct.
So, you know, we bought in via this public-private hedge fund. I let them do the picking. They're amazing. And that's how we deal with it. I couldn't, mm-hmm. you know, I can't read the papers and understand it. So to tie it back, any sort of basic science research where the government can fund the basic science, because basic science is kind of unfundable by the private market because it's not tied to a drug. There's no expected value return. You're funding discovery of new science. I mean, that's what I would be pushing. We should be doing more basic science research, government funded basic science research, because the private markets don't do it. Mm-hmm. And I would push for increased budgets at the NIH and others. And I'm hoping Biden, given his history with oncology, actually, you know, is supportive of this and pushes it. I think he will.
Yeah, and I think SPACs as a feature, as an elegant feature, I don't know your position here, but my thought, I don't get your thought, is that they came around at the right time. Like, we'll do the job that the private markets can't do, because these things need money and these things need speculators and there's going to be a lot of zeros. So I think, you know, as much as we make fun of some of this stuff happening, these are important features. This SPAC is an old idea, but the feature is now relevant.
Well, I guess, you know, it's interesting in biotech, the funding markets have been there for a while, actually. You don't, you know, these biotechs go public with seven people and some basic science and a mouse. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's existed for a while. It's the step
I like that.
It.
Science and a mouse. You're in business. I love that.
Like, well, I mean, you have plenty hilarious. Of public companies yeah, now that, right. you know, the best data they have is a mouse. Yeah. And there's I don't know if it's like a crude joke in oncology, but, you know, the best time to get cancer is if you're a mouse.
God, and, it is finally okay to get cancer if you're a mouse. You are.
Yeah, which is true, by the way. We're very good at curing cancer in mice and translating that to humans is hard. And look, the other thing I would push, and there's so much misinformation out there about like what it means to have government insurance, and it just gets twisted in so many ways that it's frustrating. But allowing a public option, whether that's Medicare Advantage for all or a buy-in option or something that gets people insurance not via their job, is a big idea. And that's how it should be. And I'm totally fine with, you can get private insurance on top and your employer can subsidize and can add extra special things, extra access, extra coverage, lower copays, whatever. They can do whatever they'd like. But the core insurance in terms of your cost should be with a group that is incentivized for your long-term health. Mm-hmm. And it's that lack of long-term health incentive that is blowing up some of, it's just that, that's the problem you ran into yourself, right? No one's in charge.
It was scary. Well, if you, other than Twitter, when you want to unwind or just be Zach Weinberg, not Brainiac, constantly in motion, what is it that you do?
Day to day. Well, I used to hang out with friends, you know, right. I had those.
That'll be back. Those but were, like, that, yeah. That so, nice. So you like doing that, correct? Is there any sports that you do? Is it Nat likes golf? Is there anything that you?
Nah, I'm too like lack of coordination, and you know, I'll dabble in the golf, but playing golf with Nat's not fun because he's too good.
Fucking kicked and pounded it. He's a player.
Yeah. Look, I live in, previous to this pandemic and hopefully in the next 3 months, I live in New York City. I like to explore the city and do the things the city provides. And honestly, I like having most of my friends not in tech. Yeah, and I think that's the fun. You know,
that's why New York's going to come back faster than San Fran and anywhere else, is because New York's got that.
It's got culture.
Yeah.
And it's got diverse culture. So I agree.
So last question, can't name a family member or me, because who wouldn't want to spend a day with me? You get to pick one person to walk the streets of New York, Woody Allen style, no phones, unlimited budget. Who do you hang out with?
That's a good question. I mean, I'd probably Zuckerberg, mostly because...
Just to hit him?
Yeah, a little bit of that. But
to change his mind or to pick his brain or to what?
I want to know if he really believes deep down that Facebook is a good thing.
That's awesome.
I just want to know that. Like, I know that he has to publicly say it, right? That's his mm-hmm. job, and he can't say anything else. But I just kind of want to know what he really believes. Like, is this better? Would the world be a better place without it? And
say he says it is. Do you hit him then? Would you go for a face shot or take out the legs?
Yeah, I'm more of a legs kind of guy. I don't, you know.
Have a last your wife if you're a legs guy.
Well, at least with like a leg shot, I can run really fast after I do it because I know I'm going to get my ass beat. So
he scares me because I just can't read him. But that's a really great answer. And I just wonder if he could trick you. I don't know if you could believe him because I don't know if he believes anything.
It's like, it reminds me of, it's, you know, when people start things and they don't exactly know what they're going to become, and then they sure. have to kind of defend them at all costs. And yeah. that's clearly what seems to have happened here. But I've always described it to people as digital cigarettes. And I believe that Facebook is the equivalent of digital cigarettes because it preys on people's kind of short-term emotions, if you will, short-term incentives. Like there's like a dopamine trigger, right? You go on, you post something, people like it. I mean, Twitter's a little bit like that too, obviously. But, sure.
Not at the same scale.
Not at the same scale. And also I think what Facebook has really done is the age range of the people actively posting on Facebook
bananas.
And their lack of ability to yeah. distinguish between what is fake and what is real.
Bananas.
They're getting taken advantage of, and it's tough to watch.
All right. This was, I'm worn out. Zach, I'm going to need a 6 months rest, but I hope to get you back when I'm recovered from this.
Let's teach you some healthcare stuff. You can do a healthcare version of the podcast.
Yeah, Gary, my partner, you're an investor in our fund, has just been an incredible pivot mentally in studying and successful investing around healthcare early stage. So it's fun to see a younger Howie or my partner, Gary, do this. Because if I was younger, that would be the only thing I'd be focused on. Because, you know, going into the hospital and just losing total control, and I'm a control freak, and it was bananas for me. And I've changed. I'm a changed person. I'm a nicer person. But I'm also, all right, Knut says no. Well, fuck off, Knut. I didn't need to know that. And so I'm so good to get to know you. So happy that you're working on this stuff. And you're optimistic, right? You're just optimistic.
Oh, yeah. I mean, bumps and bruises along the way. But we're moving faster and discovering things and inventing things at a rate that we've just never seen before. And I hope people can step back and realize that without the politics kind of destroying society. So that's the fight, right? How fast can we make the world a better place without our political system collapsing at the same time?
Yes. Amen. How do we find you? At Zach?
At Zach Weinberg.
That's your Twitter. Favorite form. You don't write long form.
I can't. I don't have the patience, you know? So, and like, nobody wants to read my long form stuff. Like, I just, I'm not that.
Your tweets are great. Follow Zach Weinberg. Thanks for your time, my man. Get through this COVID thing and we'll see you in the city.
All right, guys. Thanks for the time.
Thank you.
See you. So there you have it. 34.
We listen to a lot of impressive people here. This guy impressed the hell out of me.
I think he's top five.
Zach Weinberg for president, man. He is so well-versed.
John Street Capital.
Right.
Rom.
Yeah.
Zach is top three.
Hell yeah.
34. I think we need... Oh, Tiffany.
Oh, yeah.
24.
We probably have 30 people in the top three, Howard, because they're all amazing.
Yeah, amazing. I think he could be lying about his age.
I think he's more your age, actually. He's more mature than you, at least.
I can't
that's
get
for sure.
Nat on the podcast, his partner, who's fucking funny. Nat is like, the two of these guys have like just moved. I mean, it's unbelievable. All right. So this is Panic with Friends. You can listen to our podcast. Go to Spotify, Apple, just subscribe. Look up my name, Howard Lindzen. Look up Knut's name and you'll just see a map of Norway with the sign saying we're better than Sweden. And then search Panic with Friends. Yeah, subscribe to the podcast. We're only doing one a week because we're old and I don't want sponsors and we have things to do. So thanks, Knut, for producing this. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Tell your friends, hit the subscribe button. We talk to investors, traders, entrepreneurs, venture capitalists. We're trying to just look into the future a little bit and keep things simple. Talk to everybody soon.